We are in New York City. We've just been at the luncheon at which the Lasker Awards were presented. This is the 65th year of the Lasker Awards. And the 2010 Lasker Coachland Special Achievement Award in Medical Research went to Sir David Weatherall. Welcome. Let me just read the citation. It says, for 50 years of international statesmanship in biomedical science, exemplified by discoveries concerning genetic diseases of the blood, and for leadership in improving clinical care for thousands of children with thalassemia throughout the developing world. Could you tell me how you got into this line of business? And
yes, purely by chance, I'm afraid. In the late 1950s, when I qualified in medicine in Liverpool in the UK, after doing an internship, we had to do compulsory national service. And at that time, I knew there was some unpleasantness going on in Southeast Asia and Cyprus. So, and I hated aeroplanes. I'd never been in one. I didn't believe in the physics of flying. I don't think it should work. So I volunteered to stay in the UK to do my national service. And 3 weeks later, I was on a rather disastrous troop ship journey for Singapore. I say disastrous because we ran aground in the Suez Canal, apart from a few other things. And when I got to Singapore, much to my amazement, they asked me to take charge of the children's ward in the big military hospital, which looked after all the families of the soldiers and the Commonwealth forces. And I saved surprise because I'd never done any pediatrics, but the British Army seemed a bit short of pediatricians. And one of my very first patients was a child who'd come to Malaya and Singapore with her father in the Gurkha regiment down from Nepal. And this child had been profoundly anemic from the early years of life, and the entire diagnostic might of the British Army not been able to sort out why. And after a bit of a struggle and spending my afternoons off in the biochemistry department in Singapore University, I managed to find out the child had a disease called thalassemia. That disease has its name from two Greek roots, one thalassa, the sea, another emia, for the blood, because when it was first discovered, the severe form in the States, all the children appeared to come from the Mediterranean. So to find a patient from Nepal was a bit of a surprise. So I wrote a paper for the British Medical Journal. I thought the world ought to know about this. And that was my first paper. But unfortunately, I was called over the coals by the head of the army for the Far East to ask me whether I'd had permission from what he called the War House, which apparently is the War Office, the government's kind of control of the army. I said no. And he said, well, you can be court-martialed for this, for telling the world about military personnel without permission from the War House. And anyway, he said, it's damn bad form to tell the world that one of our best regiments has got good genes. Never do it again. But I was completely hooked by then by genetics and blood disease and the tropical disease as a whole. So I wrote back to my mentor, said, I'm coming out of the army, where can I train in these three fields in the UK? And he said, I think if anybody who asked to train in those three fields in the UK at the moment would undoubtedly be referred for psychiatric advice, you'd better go to America. So that's what I did. I came to Johns Hopkins and spent four wonderful years training in those fields. That's how it all started.
Now, what's the situation globally with thalassemia now?
Well, the March of Dimes, the big American charity, has said recently, estimated that there's about 7 million births of children with either congenital or genetic abnormalities globally each year. And remarkably, a quarter of those, 25%, are restricted to four or five disorders only. among which are the genetic disorders of hemoglobin. So on a recent countdown, we reckon there are between 300 and 400,000 babies born each year with a genetic disorder of hemoglobin, either sickle cell disease or thalassemia. And about 80% of those births are in the low or mid-income countries. So that's roughly the load. There are more sicklers than thalassemics. Reckon about probably 200 to 250,000 of these 400,000 are probably sicklers, and then the rest different forms of thalassemia. It's not one disease; several diseases.
Right. So, go back to where you just were. How did your career progress from there? I mean, there is now. I mean, the Institute for Molecular Medicine is now the eponymous Weatherall Institute for Molecular Medicine. How do you go from
well, roughly what happened was
a case to an institute named after you.
I got to Baltimore, and we did some work on the genetics and inheritance, but it was very clear to me then that we were not going to understand this disease unless we could define and pinpoint the defect, because then it was clear that it was a defect of some kind in hemoglobin production. Now, hemoglobin has got two halves, the hemoglobin molecule. It's called two alpha chains and two beta chains, the long chains of amino acids. And they're under independent genetic control. In other words, each half has got separate genes. And it was becoming clear that there must be a genetic defect in hemoglobin production by the early 60s. But it wasn't clear what the defect was. And what we needed to do was to learn how to study the synthesis, the production of hemoglobin in the test tube. And that's what I helped develop at Hopkins. And so what we found was that thalassemia is essentially a disease of unbalanced synthesis of the chains of hemoglobin. Either if you've got alpha thalassemia, you don't make enough alpha chains. If you've got beta thalassemia, you don't make enough beta chains. And it's that imbalance and the production of too many of one type of chain which damages the blood cells, joint development, and therefore stops these children being able to make blood. And it's a recessive disease, so the carriers have one defective gene for hemoglobin. These children, of course, have inherited one from each parent, so they have a severe defect. So that was the first step. That was the step at the protein level. And then, of course, at the protein level, we anticipated some of the defects at the DNA level. It was only by the early 70s and then towards the end of the 70s that the technology became available for going the next step and defining at the DNA level precisely what was the defect in these children.
I mean, the trajectory, I was thinking about some of the younger scientists down there, and the talk that Joe Goldstein, the chair of the jurors, yes, gave initially, which was a lovely talk in which he talked about creativity,
yes,
and also advice, the advice that came from practicing scientists, from various people about the kind of qualities that you needed to make discoveries. I often ask people about, you know, what is their advice to a young scientist as they look back on a career and so on. You seem to have been describing a series of accidents in retrospect, where you fell into something and something came along and you responded, but let me not put the words in your mouth. How do you feel about it?
I did discuss this with some of the students this morning. I think that my advice to youngsters, such as it is to try to stay fairly undifferentiated early on, because both in a training in medicine or a training in the biological sciences, these days leaves you so many possibilities. Unless you're absolutely fixed on something from early, wait and see and have a lot of experiences as possible. Because usually, although I would say mine was a slightly more marked accident than most, it is accidental that you'll see something as a doctor either at the bedside or as a basic scientist, an unexpected finding in the lab. And then you just follow it. I don't think, you can if you want to. I mean, I've given people much more directed career advice, but from my own experience, from the experience of all the young people, the really bright young people, it's been a slow collection of experience, and then suddenly something that's really caught them. So what I try to get them into a state of mind in the youngsters in Oxford. I mean, we do try to expose them to experiences. I mean, for the developing world, for example, when I first went to Oxford, there was nothing. And so I immediately set aside a whole day when the whole medical school stopped everything. We called it the tropical day. And we brought a series of experts from outside to tell them about diseases in the developing world, and another set of experts to bring all sorts of revolting samples in the afternoon, snakes and all sorts of bugs. And that's led to over half our students now in their elective periods going to the developing world. And I think that in itself has been an experience which has turned an awful lot of them onto. I mean, two of my students are getting awards in Canada, Gairdner Awards this year. One of them for work on malaria. He's become one of the leaders in control of malaria. And that was purely through going through that kind of process.
Gairdner Awards?
Gairdner.
Oh, yeah. The Canadian ones. Yes, yes.
So, I know it sounds a bit sloppy and undirected, but I think early acute ambition from early on is a bit destructive, I think. They should experience either the science or medicine and see where they want to go.
Did you ever consider any other career?
When I was about four, I wanted to be a plumber. But after that, and don't ask me why, there was no medicine. My father was an industrial chemist, so I'd had some experience in a dirty laboratory in the summer vacation, but no medicine in the family. It just happened. It felt like it.
Plumbing's a pretty steady job, though. There's always a need for plumbers.
Yes, but I don't know. When I'd seen doctors at work, the relationship between plumbing and surgery is pretty close. Except I had a total disaster during my career because as an intern, as a surgical intern, I was allowed to do three appendicectomies. At least I was allowed to try, and I never once found the appendix. So this awful little Welsh surgeon said to me, David, you have tried three appendicectomies and you've not yet found the appendix. Don't you think somebody up there is trying to tell you something? So I gave up being a surgeon.
Have you thought about one of the questions I often ask people is about stems from an interest in the history of science and my belief that that if you convey more about the history of science, it makes some of this.
Yes.
Greater context for what's going on now. So if I gave you a time travel token and you could bring to this table anybody you want to have a conversation with, who, anybody?
Well, I think my great hero would be somebody you may not have heard of called Sir Archibald Garrard, who was the founder of human genetics, basically. He was... And Joe Goldstein has written a couple of remarkable essays about him because he thinks he was the first real clinical scientist. He was a physician in London at the just at the time about 1900 or just before the turn of the century, when Mendelism was rediscovered for the first time. And he was a physician in London who became fascinated in abnormalities of urine. And he very carefully noted at the bedside that there was a disease associated with the passage of dark urine and joint pain that occurred in more than one family member. And he also observed that among these families there was a high frequency of cousin marriage. Mm-hmm. And he wrote his first two papers on that, and one of the great rediscoverers of Darwinism, pointed out to him that this would just be what you'd expect with a recessive inheritance. And then he wrote this classic, gave these classic lectures at the Royal College of Physicians in London in 1909, called Inborn Errors of Metabolism, which he described a whole series of these diseases. It was beautiful. I mean, he didn't know anything about genetics. He hardly used the word. He called them sports, not genes. And then when he was one of my predecessors in the Regis Chair at Oxford, he moved to Oxford, and he wrote an extraordinary book in 1932 on biochemical individuality. Really, there are not many new ideas since then, actually. All this kind of genomics and all that's really an extension of this book. Nobody's read it. It sold about 5 copies. It's called Inborn Factors in Disease, and he was the key issue, and this issue that Joe Goldstein picked up was that he was a physician, but he took that trouble to get trained in enough biochemistry, which was just a developing field at the time, to be able to take those problems from the bedside. So I wouldn't mind him across the table at all.
Well, we can see what we can arrange. What are you optimistic about?
Optimistic? Mm. You mean in my own field or in science in general?
Well, you can answer it now, however you choose, actually.
Well, there's a pessimistic view about science around at the moment, isn't it? I've just read this book, which is entitled The End of Science, which basically says that the kind of modern physicist, with his desire to find the kind of central mechanism of everything, is doomed to failure, and that the biological sciences, particularly our sciences, the genomic sciences, are just getting swept into a level of complexity which is going to just destroy them. There's no future in them. It's an interesting view, and I think it really follows one or two people rather over-optimistic view of the timescale that the human genome will produce its goods for mankind. They did it there. I mean, this idea that medicine will be revolutionized in 20 years. And it is undoubtedly packing up layer and layer of complexity. I work with thalassemia, which is a simple, so-called single gene disorder. And I've been working with a group of these children in Sri Lanka for the last 15 years. They've all got the same genetic defect, and yet I've watched them grow and develop, and not one of them is the same. And they're not trivial differences. Now we've unearthed some of the reasons. There are different genes involved. There are different, they develop, and they respond to anemia different ways at different stages of development. There's the environment. But I think people have underestimated the complexity of disease process. Now, I'm not pessimistic. I think what will happen with the monogenic diseases like our diseases, I'm seeing the beginnings of what I think a correction of some of them at the genetic level. And I think we know enough now to say that's going to be possible. For the big killers of Western society, like heart disease and stroke and so on, I think it's early days. We're doing these massive genome searches. We're getting small effects by a number of genes. But that really shouldn't surprise us. I mean, we know there's a huge environmental component to most of those diseases. I think I hope that the people who are doing that kind of work will also focus more attention in the future on the monogenic diseases, because they are easier to get at, and they may throw some light onto the mechanism of the more common variants. But I think that eventually the understanding of that genetic component will direct us much more towards the cause of these diseases. I mean, I'm just suffering from high blood pressure at the moment. And there's a few genes that are, but nothing really. We haven't advanced in our understanding of that since I was a medical student. So we do need something new. And I think that we should go on pursuing this genetic approach, because knowing the function of the genes involved, particularly in families where they do have some real effect, has the possibility of taking us to a much better understanding of the basic cause or disease mechanism.
So in terms of the relationship between science and society, I've been asking people, there's a section on the website which is actually entitled The Rightful Place. Mm. It's a reference to the President's inaugural address, we've started obviously about the restoring science to its rightful place. What is that? Where is that? What's the rightful place of science?
I think the rightful place of science is an absolutely central activity to any kind of civilization, because quite honestly, if you look back at our civilization, such as it is, most of the major developments have relied on some kind of scientific development. And so I think it's intrinsic to the development of our society. The problem, as I see it, it may be different in the United States to some degree. I think the relationship between science and the media in the UK is not entirely satisfactory. Difficult to say this, but I think the level of scientific journalism is not very strong at the moment. I know some of the very good scientific journalists, and a number of them have just seem to have got out because they're not getting enough space and they're getting very difficult treatment by sub-editors. Everything has got to be sensationalized and eye-catching. And this is, I think, saying a lot about society at the moment as well. It's saying that there isn't the interest there. And in Britain, I would put this mainly back to the level of education on science in schools, actually, which is still a big problem. Now, I don't know whether it's the same here. I know there are other problems here, of course, with kind of way out religious beliefs and so on. But it is absolutely essential, I think, that society takes education of science a lot more seriously. And gives both, we had this crazy thing in Britain recently whereby the Royal Society objected because somebody wanted to teach not just Darwinian evolution, but to tell the students in the same classes that there are other views on intelligent design and so on. And they thought this was wrong. I think that's literally ludicrous. You've got to teach Darwinian evolution, but you've got to balance it by explaining to young people that there are other views on how we got here and so on. But I think there are all these tensions within scientific teaching at the moment, and they're going to be sorted out. And I expect they're equally bad over here.
Well, actually, I thought we were back in England a couple of months ago talking with Martin Rees and various people, yeah. Oxford and Cambridge. I personally thought there was actually a thriving interest in science there, but compared
really?
To here. So
how interesting.
Yeah.
One of the things
that I do find is that there seems to be a requirement for science to deliver certainty, delivery, certitude, whereas in fact that's not, as you would doubtless point out, how science is done.
And I had a year, I was president of the British Association for 1 year, that's the year you really see a lot of science, the media, and what I can understand newspapers wanting to sell, but it is impossible actually to try to get a moderate view of a particular scientific development. They didn't want ifs and buts. There had to be a certainty. Otherwise, they're kind of sub-editors who are going to chuck it out. And this is the big problem, I think, getting over to the public that science is not an exact pastime. But it's a rather boring message, isn't it? That's the problem, I think.
So, what are you working on now?
Well, two things. It's difficult getting research money in the UK when you've retired, I can tell you. I do get supported by the charity, the Wellcome Trust, and they did write to me last year and said, well, we'll give you another year, but if you're coming back again, please let us know in good time. And then somebody had written on the bottom with a medical certificate. So what I hope I'm working on, the commonest form of thalassemia in Asia is a very frustrating disease because it's so variable in its clinical picture and phenotype. Some children are lifelong transfusion dependent, others with the same genetic makeup can go through life quite well. And we're trying to sort out the reasons for that and trying to sort out how we can identify them early because I think there's an enormous amount of wastage of blood in Asia. I mean, that's our big objective of the moment, to understand that disease. And then the other thing I'm doing, which I've been doing for the last since retirement actually, taking the idea of this partnership between the rich and poor countries the next step. So we've got places like India and Sri Lanka and Thailand where there's excellent people in this field now. And the idea is, can we link them with adjacent countries where there's nothing? I mean, there's a huge thalassemia problem in Cambodia, and there's a huge one in Bangladesh. So we're trying to get link programs between the two. And I'm trying to persuade government that it's a very cost-effective approach of doing. It's much better than slinging money at their aid at their governments, and with limited success. And because the big international health agencies are still very much stuck on communicable disease. And I don't think they've still grasped the kind of time bomb they're sitting on with these inherited blood diseases. I mean, just one example, we reckon there's probably about 250,000 to 300,000 births a year of sickle cell disease in sub-Saharan Africa alone. Most of those kids are dead by the age of five. Some of my own students have recently discovered that the reason they're dead is not what was thought for all these years, malaria was killing them. It's infection by simple organisms, which are the same as kill the babies here. And very simple screening and prophylaxis would keep those kids going. Now, if you think of that, even if they lived to half the age of the present mean survival of a child in Africa, we're talking about 6 million sicklers. And I think somehow we're going to have to get these, trying to get these messages over to government. But there are cost-effective ways of helping them. And I've been talking with the people at NIH. I think there's a lot of interest here in this country now in this approach. So that's what I'm doing. That keeps me off the streets in retirement.
We must keep you off the streets.
Yeah, you must.
And so perhaps we can talk about this again, but you have to come back with a medical certificate.
I will do that.
Thank you. Okay. David Weatherall, thank you.